the method.
Ideas. Method became
unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
Without doubt. Do you call it unsound method?
I don't see any method at all.
Hello, dear listener. Welcome to the latest episode of Unsound Methods with me, Jamie Batchin.
And me, Lachlan Bloom. For those of you listening for the first time, this is a podcast where we speak to fellow writers of literary fiction about their technique and motivations.
So we're recording this intro at the start of October, near the start of October.
Near middle of October already.
Time flies. It's autumn already. The year is starting to wind down a bit. And the Goldsmiths Prize shortlist has just been announced. Very interesting shortlist. I think we got Will Eaves, friend of the pod, who's got Murmur on there, an excellent book.
You can listen to Will talk to us earlier in the year about Murmur and other things writing related.
He's actually a second time nominee, I think, because the Absent Therapist, I think, was also on there. So
I didn't know that.
Another returning writer is Rachel Cusk, who I believe is called the Transit Trilogy, but Kudos, which is the third part of that, is on there. It's a very interesting book.
I've got In Our Mad and Furious City by Guy Gunnarant.
Yeah, that's good. A very London-based book there, but very interesting. Lots of the current sort of social tensions, I think, they're going on are dealt with there in a very imaginative way.
The Long Tape by Robin Robertson.
Which is interesting. That's a blank verse prose poem. It's interesting. Although I'm reading it not long after having read John Dos Passos's 1919, and they're kind of covering the same ground, and so I keep forgetting what's from this book and what's from the other one. But there we go, that's the kind of imaginative feedback loop that you get from novels. So this week's episode,
this week we speak to Lars Eyre, although we actually spoke to Lars last year,
probably in the beginning of autumn last year.
We spoke remotely, so the maybe some issues on the line, I think.
Sound is not perfect, and there might be some slight delays with responses. We've edited it up, but I think there's a little bit of a... You can tell that we're not in the same room as him, but it was an interesting chat with Lars.
Yeah, we talked about his Spurious trilogy and his route from writing blog posts to writing novels, and more about his latest book, which I think he emailed thing has just been... with Melville Hyde.
Yeah, so the second part of his second trilogy has just been signed up. We'll have more information about that in the text below.
But for now, here's Lars Eyre.
So first off, I thought it'd be good just to ask you if you could speak to us a bit about your route into fiction writing.
Yeah, sure. Like many other fiction writers, I had the ambition to write from an early age. So I felt a sense of vocation. But as Clarice Lispector, the great Brazilian novelist, reflects, you know, vocation is different from talent. You know, you can have vocation, but not talent. You can feel called, but you don't know how to go. And although I wrote creatively, if that's what it's called, I didn't know how to go. So the European modernists, who I'd begun to read before going to study at university, pointed a way for me. And eventually this led me to read the critical work and fiction of Maurice Blanchot. And I was especially interested in his difficult notion of the narrative voice, and ended up doing a PhD in philosophy, exploring the background to Blanchot's thought in philosophy, and spent the next few years giving myself a grounding in continental philosophy, as it's called, European philosophy of the 19th and 20th centuries. And you know, through all this, I continue to work. I continue to write creatively. I felt the same sense of vocation, but I still didn't know how to proceed. My own writing didn't convince me. I could never really bring my material alive. Now, I spent a lot of time working hard to get an academic job, but once I got one, once it became permanent, I began to blog. I wanted to continue to explore what Blanchot meant by the narrative voice, but to leave behind all the norms of academic writing. I became very captivated by the medium of blogging, and I was so interested in it, I thought, okay, this is it. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. I'm going to devote myself to this. I have no ambitions outside of writing blogs. And on my blog, I experimented. I tried out different styles of writing. I found an audience, and I was part of something. And there's no gatekeepers in the world of blogs. You could write what you wanted. You could follow your whims, your interests, your obsessions. There's always a minimal contact with an audience. Another thing about blogging was you could write alongside others who had similar aims. You could be part of something, sort of fellowship of writers. Now, at the blog, I did philosophical things, Blanchotian things, but I also began to introduce some humorous elements. And it's a way in which I'd never written before. I poked fun at my failures, you know, to understand what I was reading. I poked fun at the failures of a friend of mine by calling a blog W to realise his philosophical ambitions. And I sort of stumbled into this distinctive style of the W and Lars material, which I would use for my first three novels, by this happy accident. I didn't put much thought into it. You know, I experimented with sort of Bernhardian, Sebaldian style indirect narration, and by dialogue style auto-critiques. But the first W and Lars post I wrote at the blog was a real leap forward for me, one I didn't really appreciate at the time. I didn't really give it much thought, you know, though the audience seemed to like it. So I all along had the same sense of creative vocation. And I was busy at the blog developing other styles of writing on this and that. But, you know, I could never really bring that material alive, and I wasn't sure why. I think this was because there was an unbridgeable gap between my world, the world of contemporary Britain, and that of the thinkers and writers I admired. And the reason why the W and Lars material worked, why it had life, why readers liked it, is because it was able to confront this gap, to turn it into a theme. So I couldn't satisfy myself with developing a new strategy of writing in the tradition of the great European modernists, because my relationship to that tradition was really dubious. It was even spurious. And that was the word I used for the blog and for my first novel. So what I did in the W and Lars material is to draw without thinking on a very British comic tradition, a tradition which is so all-pervasive, so obvious, that it didn't even stand out to me as a tradition. It was simply the water in which, you know, I was immersed. So then came the W and Lars posts with their intellectual slapstick, echoes of With Nell and I, of Pete and Dud. And this was a very easy thing for me to write. You know, the humour is natural to me. It's how I speak to my friends. It's British. It's true to contemporary Britain. And it's by preserving sort of to and fro of that kind of speech as filtered through the techniques of indirect narration and a kind of jump cut montage that I gave to my material what it lacked previously, life. So I've become a kind of writer of a strip cartoon telling stories about W and Lars. And, you know, like Charles Schulz or George Harriman, I was these strip cartoons, I couldn't rely on readers having followed it from the start. I was always having to present these characters and their situation anew in a manner vivid enough to engage any potential reader. Each post had to have its internal drama, a kind of verbal slapstick, even as it could be contained within a larger narrative arc. But as I went on, you know, it really occurred to me that the material deserved to be developed at greater length. Rather than being a strip cartoon, I wanted to think in terms of a novel. And that's when I began to put together Spurious, the novel, where I used the blog as a compositional tool and, you know, drawing on some older material, but also writing a lot of new material. And that's what I also did with the subsequent novels in that trilogy.
Had you planned what would happen to W and Lars sort of beforehand, or was it quite freeform? Each time you needed to write a blog post, you'd come up with it as you were working?
Yeah, there's no plan at all. There was no character arcs, there's, you know, nothing at all like that. It was simply these characters, their dynamism, their to and fro, their verbal slapstick, very much like you know, the Peanuts. You know, we got Charlie Brown and Lucy and Snoopy, and what Charles Schulz does is present these characters to you freshly each time you read, you know, a strip cartoon. And similar with me, I at that point I had no idea of a story arc, but as I went on, as I began to produce Spurious, the novel, Dogma and Exodus, as I went on, I began to become more interested in exploring themes at greater length. And exploring, well, there's a very little plot, but exploring some of their interactions, some of their adventures at greater length.
Because the scope of their adventures, if you like, it expands over the trilogy, I guess, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
They find themselves further afield. So, I'd always assumed that you'd planned quite carefully beforehand where they would go, but.
No, no planning at all. In fact, I had no idea it was going to be a trilogy. But as I went on, you know, I wanted the second and third volumes of the trilogy to explore the constitution of the characters, they're shaping by various social and political factors. So I wanted the readers to learn more about Lars, the narrator, and more about W, the person Lars speaks about, and to learn how their characters were formed in contemporary Britain under particular conditions, that of our neoliberal capitalism. They're working in institutions that are seeing great changes. And this became something which interested me more and more. And in the end, you know, Exodus is actually quite different from Spurious, because it explores this constitution of these characters, where the characters come from. Spurious can seem like a belated contribution to the literature of the absurd, but I think as you move through Spurious, Dogma, and Exodus, this absurdism is grounded in an account of what it's like to live now in Britain, what it's like to work in a university, what it's like to be interested in certain authors who always had a very marginal presence in Britain.
And with the blog posts that led to it, were they? I've sort of had a look at a few of them. Were they? Did people take them as fact, as a sort of frustrated academic writing about what was going on, or do you think everyone was in on the joke, as it were, at the start?
No, I think people enjoyed the humour of them. They saw the humour. You know, many people have told me over the years that they enjoyed these posts. You know, it's quite strange. You bump into people and they tell you they were readers all along, which is very gratifying. So I think people understood the humour, got the humour, got the idea of Lars poking fun at himself, poking fun at W. So I think people were in on that joke.
And do you think that's sort of, I mean, are you still exploring the potential of blogs for the production of literature, or have you moved on from that?
As the trilogy wore on, it was a very simple, very contingent factor. The computer I was working on was a load of old rubbish, and I wasn't able to work with it as I used to be able to. So when I began writing Exodus, more and more of it was handwritten. Instead, you know, the computer was such a problematic thing. And Wittgenstein Jr. was virtually all handwritten, and the novel I'm writing now is all entirely handwritten. I don't really use a computer at all, apart from for editing. So I moved away from the blog format because just for sort of contingent reasons, you know, I became really frustrated with the technology I was using.
What are some of those frustrations on a practical level? What do you feel flows easier with pen and paper than it does on a computer or laptop?
Well, this is probably a test to my lack of technical ability, but my computer is always crashing. My version of Word is crashes every 15 or 20 minutes. So, you know, I've had more than one new computer, and I've had the person who works in technology here at the university look at it, and he can only suggest that the documents I'm using are cursed in some way, because they don't seem to work properly. So for that reason, you know, I write longhand, which is actually a very nice and easy way to work. It's very portable, but it means an unbelievable amount of transcription. So the novel I'm working on right now, which will be about 150,000 words, it's nearly done. I've written for that 1.2 million words. I had to transcribe all of that from notebooks and then edit it, which was absolutely enormous as a task. Wow, it drives me crazy.
Yeah, that's quite a big, a large volume of words. Do you find that process of transcribing from paper back into a computer, is that helpful in the editing process? Do you kind of write at that point as well? Are you changing a lot, or is it purely a matter of paring the words down to?
I just transcribe like an idiot. I just copy it all out. Because one thing I've learned over the years is, you know, try and keep the original form, even if it doesn't look good straight away. Just try and stay with what you've written and the order in which it's written, and work with that, you know. Mm. So I just sit there like a monkey copying out, you know, copying out the notebook. I normally put some podcast on or something to entertain me. So it's just a purely mechanical process. But editing is an enormous process for me. That's something really difficult to do. With the kind of material that I'm writing, where it's not plot-driven, the great task is, how do you fit this together into some kind of narrative? And that is really, really trying.
And have you found a technique for that, or is that each individual work decides the method for the deciding?
Yeah, I guess it's pretty much each individual work. But the thing I'm doing at the moment, I took 6 months editing it, really, just moving bits of text around, so I found a structure. And this is, you know, the principle of sort of literary montage. We have to try and combine the shots together, like a filmmaker, combine the scenes together. until something seemed to work. And, you know, I was very encouraged by the example of Andrei Tarkovsky, you know, who was when he was constructing his autobiographical film Mirror, sequenced it 15, 20 times. He was always there in the studio, cutting it in different ways, reordering it and reordering it until he found a version that he felt worked. And that's similar to, for me, that I'm trying to construct something where there's not a strong plot element, but what I want is a movement from lofty philosophical scenes where people are discussing high-fluting things, plunging right down to the everyday, into the utterly banal. So I want a movement of the low and the high. I want a rhythm where there's nothing lofty that's allowed to exist and have its way for very long before being pushed right down into the mud.
Taking that parallel with the sort of film editing process, is the process more akin to ordering passages that you write in the first instance, and then you're happy with how they are internally, but you want to change the order of them as a film editor might do with rushes? Or are you effectively going back to reshoot scenes because you look at it and think, no, this passage is trying to say this, but it's not. I'm going to rewrite it as, you know, as Tarkovsky might go back to the location and reshoot it because there's something inherently wrong with the rushes he has.
That's interesting. I mean, what I tend to have is just little fragments of scenes that I know I can develop into a full scene. I can do that later. Mm. So, for example, in the current novel, I have a scene where it's about a band, you know, a musical band, and they're having their band photos taken. And rather than actually develop that then and there, I just simply have a sort of stub where that scene's going to be. And then I move it into a place where I think it's going to work. Then I go back and, as it were, reshoot that and amplify it and open it out. And what I do, because this novel's taken, the one I'm not writing now is called Nietzsche and the Burbs. Because Nietzsche and the Burbs has taken about 3 years so far, I have loads of time to think what's going to happen in these scenes. So what I'm doing in editing is moving around a bunch of stubs. Then I begin to read about them, develop them, open them out. I develop different things that happen in each scene. The characters change somewhat. And so it's a sort of dialectic. It's a movement between moving scenes around, reshooting. That's the way in which I've been working over the last 3 years.
So you were talking about the title of the latest novel. Is it acting as a second part of a trilogy to Wittgenstein Jr. as well, with a non-academic setting in this case?
Yeah, absolutely. This one's about school kids, basically. It's about people who are 16, 17, 18. They're in a sixth form of a school down south in the suburbs of London. They form a band. And, you know, just like the previous novel in this trilogy, there's someone who's similar to this historical philosopher appearing in their midst. In this case, the philosopher who appears is Nietzsche. And in the previous novel, it was Wittgenstein. But this novel is not set in the university, it's set in the school, it's set in the suburbs. And the idea is to bring Nietzsche to life in this very surprising context and see what happens. So he becomes the lead singer of this band. And, I won't spoil what happens, but Nietzsche's life in this book is very similar to his life in reality. So it's not a happy ending for him in that sense.
Do you take anything from the artistic process of creating music in that? As a band features in the
novel. And the thing for me was to try and think about the idea of creation and creativity as such, and that's a constant concern I've had in all my fiction. I always have some musings on the creation, the biblical creation, normally. And what's interesting about the biblical creation is the idea that certainly in the Jewish tradition, that God creates the universe not out of nothing but out of chaos. So God creates the universe out of chaos and makes something ordered. And the thing is about this order is that this order is only provisional, so that the work of creation is ongoing to try and hold chaos at bay. And sometimes in the Bible, you know, God says, right, let chaos break in. So you have the flood, the biblical flood. So you have the various things that prophets see in the future. You have these disasters occurring where chaos breaks back into the order of creation, of the created world. And that, for me, is really interesting as a model of creativity in general. And in Nietzsche and the Burbs, one of the things I'm exploring is the attempt of this band to create some kind of order out of chaos, and but unfortunately being unable to hold the chaos at bay. So the chaos breaks into the music. It's an improvisational band, pretty much. That they're improvising. They're working with provisional structures, but all the time they're trying to open their music to something which disrupts those structures. And that gives the life to their music, but it also makes their music very risky. So in that sense, it's similar to the historical Nietzsche and the way in which Nietzsche himself thinks about creativity as involving a relationship to chaos, to the Dionysian. But the historical Nietzsche was always afraid of being overwhelmed by the Dionysian. There's always a dialectic, some sort of relationship between chaos and order, between Dionysius and Apollo in Nietzsche's work too. So that's one of the principal themes I'm exploring, as I explore it really in different versions in all the fiction I write.
And how do you feel within the writing process? Where do you feel your creative process sits in that sort of dialectic between chaos and order? Do you sort of struggle to let chaos in, or are you struggling to keep chaos at bay when you sort of sit down in front of the page?
It's always a struggle not to let your work just become totally chaotic, not just let it sprawl and give it over entirely to indeterminacy. So that's something which any writer will struggle with, the idea of giving it some sort of form. And what I've done in the current trilogy I'm working on, it's based on the lives of real philosophers. So that gives me a basic structure to work with. Otherwise, it could go anywhere. So that gives me the basic order. But then I want, at the same time, to let that order tremble or shudder, to disrupt its outlines, to blur it somewhat. I want to make its borders indeterminate in some way. But I have the order there, and that's what helps me enormously as a writer to base what I'm doing on the lives of these philosophers.
Thank you for listening to Unsound Methods. You've reached the midpoint of this podcast. Now might be a good time to go make a nice cup of tea.
Help yourself to a biscuit.
You write pretty, unconventional is the word, and sort of very philosophical novels with big ideas in them. How does your relationship work with your editor or publisher and people? Are you left alone to get on with things as you see fit, or?
Oh yeah, it's kind of fun actually working with a publisher. I published with Melville House, and the first novel I wrote, Spurious, there was virtually no editing done at all. It was just as I sent it. So it's a tiny amount of editing done, absolutely minuscule. But the second novel, Dogma, that was really great fun because the guy working as a publicist for Melville House, he liked the novels and he wanted to work with me as an editor. And the great thing about a small publishing house is that you can allow that. Yeah, the roles aren't so specialised. So I started working with Nathan, that's the publicist's name. He became my editor and he had really interesting ideas for Dogma. I ended up taking out 10% of the Dogma and replacing it with 15% of new material. It was longer than it was when I submitted it. So Nathan was really instrumental in shaping that novel and really making me rethink what I was doing. The third novel, Exodus, likewise, so a similar sort of editing process, was really quite involving. I enjoyed it. For me, you know, the analogy is always with music. I always think of a producer working with a band, and that producer can really help that band bring out elements of their sound. So I feel I need a producer, someone I work with closely, who can help me bring out certain elements of what it is I do. Now, Wittgenstein Jr. as a text was something which was very hard to complete because I'd agreed on a date when I handed in the finished version of the text. But you know, that time in my personal life, things were very complicated. We were renovating a house. Various other things were going on, births and deaths and all kinds of things. It meant that, you know, it was really, really hard to assemble material. So in that instance, I actually leaned on my editor even more strongly. My editor suggested in this case that I follow the classic Hollywood film script guide, where you plot the action rising, you bring it to a boiling point, and you have the action fall away. So in that case as well, the editing, you know, was quite intensive, and that really helped me shape my material. But the first person who edits my work at the moment really is my wife, and she's fantastic at editing. And she's editing the current novel at the moment, and she really is wonderful. She's the first person who's editing this novel, as she edited Exodus and Dogma. But in this novel, she's the one who's really working with me on it and trying to shape this enormous 150,000-word piece that I'm working on. And I haven't actually submitted it yet to the publisher. I'll probably submit it in November and see what they make of it. I'm hoping that they find it interesting. I'm not sure I'll be working with now at the publisher as an editor. But you know, I'm looking forward to that process.
And with your wife as the sort of first reader and first editor, how early in the process would you start to show her things?
Well, you know, I only show it when it's absolutely finished in my mind, then I show it to her. You know, she's really very busy. She writes books herself. So, you know, she's someone who really doesn't have any time. So if I'm going to show her something, it's got to be pretty much perfect. And this particular novel, you know, had to be done for me to give it to her. And she's doing great work. You know, she's really helping me out line by line, the line edits, just to try and make it more funny, more compact, make the characters more, make what they say more punchy. So those things are absolutely invaluable to me. You know, being edited is crucial to what it is I do. I can get totally lost. And she always says that editing my work is like thinning out someone's hair when you're brushing it. Stuff, if I left to myself, it becomes so repetitious, it becomes so caught in these rhythms that it can be very challenging for the reader. And what she does is get me to pare back these rhythms, pare back the thickness of the text, and try and make it absolutely clear and absolutely readable, which is always my dream. I want my stuff to be very, very readable.
It seems from your first studies and all the way through your work, this sort of dichotomy between a sort of desire to write philosophy and to write fiction that's alive, that those two elements seem to be present throughout all your work. And I was wondering what you feel fiction adds, why write fiction as opposed to purely focusing on philosophy, and you know, whether that's changed at all in the time that you have written fiction, how you feel whatever fiction adds, how that changes.
Yeah, I mean, philosophy as a discipline is incredibly difficult. I mean, it's really, really hard. And this word philosopher should only be really saved as an honorific for thinkers who are very good at it. And I was never really a philosopher in that sense. You know, I really tried, I really worked at it, but I wasn't really able to achieve what I wanted to achieve. I wasn't able to produce original thought, as I think some philosophers are able to. And, you know, philosophy can be daunting and a bit saddening, because it makes you aware of what's really important, what really matters, and how inadequate you are with respect to the task of thinking what really matters. And the purpose of philosophy, in some sense, is to, as Deleuze says, you know, very, very nicely, is to damage stupidity, to turn stupidity into something shameful. And what often happens is that you feel ashamed of your own stupidity, and you become, you know, it saddens you. Well, the solution to that lies in fiction. Now, Samuel Beckett gave a wonderful interview in which he was asked, "Why do you write books?" And Beckett said, "I don't know. I'm not an intellectual. I just feel things. I invented Molloy and the rest on the day I understood how stupid I'd been. I began then to write down the things I feel." And likewise, for me, through the process of blogging, you know, I began to feel things. I was able to invent these characters. As I understood how stupid I'd been, I began to write down the things I felt about my inadequacy with respect to what I wanted to do philosophically. The question in my fiction was how to write about the stupidity, how to mark the distance between the philosophical concerns of the characters, my concerns too, and the world in which they live. So the idea then was, how can you bring this to life? Now, some philosophers themselves are able to do this within their work. Some, like the philosopher Kierkegaard, and he actually really realizes a great deal of comedy in juxtaposing the characters' ostensible interests with their more petty concerns in his work. That kind of comedy is really very much present in a thinker like Kierkegaard, and it's present in different ways in thinkers like Georges Bataille, or perhaps in Maurice Blanchot as well. So I had figures who I could look to. But what I did in my own work was simply try and focus on stupidity, but also the sense in which contemporary Britain is very different from the philosophical world in which I was interested in. And that contemporary Britain had no real interest in the philosophical world in which I was interested. You know, there's a complete disjunction between the world that I experienced every day and my intellectual interests. And that sort of sense of stupidity led to the comedy of the Spurious Trilogy. And it's also the same comedy as in the current trilogy I'm writing. It's all about these philosophers who find themselves in the banal, mundane, ordinary world.
Do you feel a similar disconnect between the contemporary world of literature and the the world of literature that you're interested in? Because I know there's quite a lot of reference to Kafka, and you were suggesting sort of the Bernhard sort of style that you had in the blog post. Do you think the same things happened there as with philosophy?
I think, yeah, it's an interesting question. I do feel that disconnection. I don't feel part of a literary world or a literary tradition. My interests are just totally remote compared to mainstream British fiction. That has nothing to do with it. I don't feel any affinity with contemporary British authorship, really, or much Anglophone writing, to be honest. So I don't feel any connection of that kind. But this connection is not one I feel particularly acutely, because I've never been around people who are interested in literature, really. You know, people around me have always been interested in philosophy. So I have a much more acute relationship to philosophy, much more difficult and fraught one. And with literature, it's something much more comic. So it actually amuses me that my fiction really has no connection with contemporary fiction, and that my, that I'm not really engaged in that world. So I find it quite entertaining. I find it actually really quite funny. One day I'll do a novel about it, I think. But so that disconnection I feel in literature is one which is for me very, very funny. You know, it's comic. I laugh at it.
You mentioned Kierkegaard there, bringing elements of humour into his work, his philosophical work, and there's obviously a huge range of approaches to philosophy. Do you feel that within the sort of canon of philosophical work, you can kind of achieve every kind of aim, or are there some areas that philosophy can't reach that fiction can? Are there reasons to write fiction that go beyond what can be achieved by philosophical inquiry?
Yeah, it's very interesting. So typically in philosophy, you know, philosophers use the arts to exemplify their ideas. So Stanley Cavell reads Shakespeare to confirm the philosophical notions he develops in his readings of Wittgenstein and Descartes and so on. So philosophy provides a theory which is exemplified by particular writers and particular artists. And the traffic between philosophy to that extent is normally one way. And philosophy retains a transcendent position with respect to the arts. So artistic practices await their an appropriate conceptual paraphrase if they're going to be able to reveal their latent philosophical content. And until that moment, you know, artistic materials, the arts, these writers remain sub-philosophical, being just secondary with respect to philosophy. Now, this understanding of philosophy is challenged by various outliers, various unusual thinkers like Nietzsche, Kierkegaard, Georges Bataille, thinkers like Blanchot. So that model is challenged. We find a challenge to it in the work of Deleuze, who argues that the encounter with the arts jolts philosophers out of entrenched habits of thought, leading to the production of new concepts. And that's what Deleuze emphasizes in his own writing on the arts, on cinema, on painting, on Francis Bacon's paintings, for example. You know, he argues that painting engages the body in a becoming other, opening a world of impersonal affects and percepts. But in, you know, Deleuze's position, although it's an advance on the classical philosophical tradition, still doesn't really allow artworks to constitute modes of philosophical research in their own right. And that's why I think Kierkegaard's interesting, Nietzsche's interesting, Blanchot, Bataille, other things of this kind, Ellen Cixous is also very interesting here, because what these thinkers are doing is they're thinking with their medium, they're thinking with literary writing. So what they're doing is, rather than giving a philosophically transcendent account of what's happening in the arts, they're using the arts themselves as a mode of research, perhaps philosophical research, in their own right. So that's why, that's how they sort of invert the hierarchies and do philosophy, if what they do can be called philosophy, and through writing. Interestingly, you know, in contemporary philosophy, François Laruelle has been arguing for the necessity of broadening and extending the notion of what is to count as philosophical thinking. And he's been very, very critical of the privileged status of philosophy. So following Laruelle's lead, it's interesting to think about how philosophy can be understood to be imminent in, implicit to, various kinds of, if I can call it this, performance, you know, not just theatrical, not just performance in a theatre, but performances which are literary as well.
Can I just ask you quickly about what draws you to trilogies?
Sure. So, you know, I fell into writing a trilogy, the Spurious trilogy. I asked the publishers what they thought was the best idea when it came to this material. And, you know, word reached me, you know, write a trilogy. So I thought, okay, fine, I'll write a trilogy. Well, the reason why I enjoy working with trilogies is because I felt with Aspirius, I discovered an idiom, a way of writing, which is particular to me, which readers enjoyed. I felt, okay, let's try and work with this idiom, try and do things with it, try out things. And that's the idea of using a whole trilogy to do this, to explore the way in which the characters were constituted, the way in which they were shaped by various social and political factors. So Dogma Exodus followed, where you deepen the account of the characters, their background, the world in which they're operating in. Likewise, the trilogy I'm working on now is something similar. I've got a slightly different idiom, a different style, but again, I think it has potential. I think it's an intriguing style to work with. And actually what I'm doing with this trilogy is telling the same kind of story three times in three different ways. This trilogy takes the form of a triptych, and I'm working on the large central panel of this triptych at the moment, Nietzsche and the Burbs, which tells roughly the same story as Wittgenstein Jr., but just in a slightly different way. I'll do something similar with the third novel in the sequence. I haven't got a fixed title for that, but I'm actually working on that at the moment as well, and that novel is based on the life of Simone Weil. So that's the idea of a trilogy for me. It allows you to really make the most of the idiom you discovered and plunge more deeply into it and enjoy it, and hopefully have the readers enjoy it too.
And how are you finding working on two novels at the same time? Or are you used to that? Perhaps you'd done that previously.
Oh, yeah, I often do that, to be honest, you know. I always think happily of when I actually have more time, you see, because now I've got a young family, I've got a very busy job. But in the older days, you know, when we had a young baby, I used to work in the mornings on Exodus and the afternoons on Dogma. It was wonderful, really wonderful doing that. But nowadays it's different, so I have to get up early. If I'm going to write, if I've got any time to write, I've got to get up at 5, you know, in the morning. So I get up at 5. Actually, yesterday I got up at 4, which is unbelievable, so early. And, you know, I've got a couple of hours, hour and a half, say, before everyone wakes up. So I try and write new material, which I'm going to use for the new novel. And then if I get time in the daytime, I might do a bit of editing. I might just look at a scene and add a few words here and there, add a bit of dialogue here and there. But, you know, my energies at the moment are going into producing the new novel. I've been working on that for a while. I've got a notebook that I've yet to transcribe. It's 100,000 words now I've got to transcribe, which I'm absolutely dreading. And, you know, but I'll be interested to do so because then I'll see what I've been up to. But at present, all it is just setting a mood, setting an atmosphere. There are barely any characters. It's just lots and lots of writing about the particular setting. It's set in Manchester. So it's all writing about the setting and trying to feel my way into a mood, into affects, which are suitable for the story I want to tell.
And in terms of balancing your sort of daily life between fiction writing and philosophy, do you... foresee a stage where you would be devoting more time to fiction, or is it a sort of equilibrium that you feel is most productive having both elements on a daily basis as part of your work?
Well, what I do now, really, I'm focusing on the fiction. Just time wise, it's just so hard to find any time to do anything else. And what I hope eventually is to produce some kind of hybrid form. Sort of literary, philosophical hybrid, but that's maybe 10 years away. All I can do at the moment is just try and do what I can with the small amounts of time that I have at my disposal. So if I have a couple of hours in the morning, or maybe an hour and a half before everyone gets up in the morning, I just try and write stuff. And I don't really think a great deal about, you know, what it's going to be, where it's going to go. It could be something philosophical, but normally something literary. So I hope, you know, I don't know when it's going to be, maybe 20 years' time, you know, if I live that long. One day I'll be able to look at have a whole day to work with, and then I can think about, right, you know, what do I want to do philosophically? But the moment I'm really focusing on literature, because that is it's actually easier to write for me than trying to write philosophical things.
And do you often come if you come to a concept that you feel is interesting or new? Are you ever sort of torn whether to write it from an academic philosophical perspective or from a fictional perspective? Is there ever some tension there whether to explore a concept one way or the other, or is it normally quite clear, well, this is going to be fiction, or this is going to be philosophy?
Yeah, I mean, really nowadays, because this time is so pressing, I just try and respond to things in terms of their creative potential. I think, okay, how will this work for me creatively, rather than thinking about writing an academic paper on it? And that's a shame, because I'd like to do both, really. And the danger is you become too uncritical with the material you're working on. So I would like to write in a much more formal manner about some of the ideas that interest me. But, you know, I've got to pick something I've got time to do. And that is very much literary fiction. And literary fiction, yeah, as I say, it's easier. Philosophy is really heartbreaking if you don't have time to do it. But you're trying to do something where you need plenty of peace and quiet. And you need time. And if you haven't got that, then you become totally, totally frustrated. Whereas with literary writing, the way I write, you can squeeze it into the day as you have it. You know, especially with these short scenes that I write, you can just jot down a short scene or add to a short scene if you have even 20 minutes spare. So in that sense, I've got to think pragmatically. And that's why I'm drawn to doing literary things rather than philosophical ones at the moment.
And you were turning this latest novel into the publisher in November, you were saying, you hoped.
Yeah, that's right.
And
yeah.
What's the anticipated time frame after that?
It's a year to publication normally. So I'll wait and see if they want it, you know, see if they think it's something they want to work with. I hope they do. This one's actually, it's as long as the trilogy all put together. And it's supposed to be a sort of comprehensive, aesthetic, philosophical whole, you know, political, economic, even economic whole. So it's supposed to be something which really, really, it's a big work. But we'll see whether they want to take that or not, whether they think they can publish that. Hopefully they will. And then I'll be working with them on that, I'd say, for a few months. But I don't think there'll be that much editing this time round. I might be wrong, but I think actually it's fairly complete. I don't think there's much to do on it, really. And what I'm looking forward to is just typing up the stuff I'm working on now about Simone Weil. And I really hope that project doesn't take 3 years, but it's much, much quicker. You know, I really hope now to write something a bit shorter. Who knows whether that'll happen or not. It depends on the material. The material really dictates that. But I hope to write something just a bit shorter and more manageable, because editing and working on this piece has been really pretty tough with all the other things going on.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the length of it. If it's 150,000 words, give or take, it is considerably longer than your previous work. So that was just the material itself dictated that, did it?
Yeah, because, you know, even the first year, at the end of the first year, 2014, when I began it, you know, I already had 80,000 words. I thought, well, this is great, you know, plenty of material. But as I looked at it, it was just dead. It was really flat on the page. And, you know, I began to see the only lively bits were dialogue. And in the end, what happened is I just produced 150,000 words, mostly a dialogue, because the dialogue is much more lively. And it's really painful. You know, you write, dialogue's actually very hard to write. Direct dialogue is a bloody nightmare. You know, what I normally did in the previous novels was to move between direct and indirect writing. But with this novel, with Nietzsche and the Birds, it's all direct. Everything is direct. It's really tough to do. It's all happening, as it were, in real time. And it's just enormously tough to write in that way. And to write a novel of 150,000 words like that, oh, my God. And then, you know, you end up cutting your favourite bits. I just cut 50 pages, which took me probably 6 months. I just cut it because, you know, it wasn't really working. So this sort of struggle emerges out of the attempt to give life to the material. And, you know, it was clear that the material was just too flat to work. And it needed far more levity. The conversations got to be much more funny. You know, there had to be a lot more comedy going on. And that is what I hope I've been able to achieve. So I hope this one is actually a significant step on from anything I've done before. That's the idea, at least. Then with the next one, the Weil novel, you know, it may well be I have a similar problem, because I've written a lot of stuff. I enjoyed writing it. 100,000 words, you know, tighten it all up, see what I have. And there's very little dialogue there. And it may well be it's lifeless. It may just be totally dead. And it only seemed, you know, interesting to me to write at the time.
And at what point can you tell about the aliveness of it? I mean, is that in your first initial read through of what you've written?
Yeah. You can see it there. You think, oh, my God, something's gone horribly wrong here. I remember I actually work in an English school of English now rather than philosophy. And when I started here, there was a computer disaster, and I lost probably 180,000 words of material. It was totally wiped from the computer. And I was kind of glad, because it was just dead stuff, you know? Dead.
I admire you being able to feel glad about losing that much material.
Well, but since then, I've written another 840,000 words. you know, a lot of that is dead as well, but some of it's quite lively. So hopefully, you know, the next novel won't take so long and be so damn difficult. I mean, geez, you know, when you're halfway through a novel like that, when you know it's going to be something really long, it's just really frustrating. What's nice is to write a novel, it goes out, it gets reviewed, you're doing interviews, it's great fun doing all that stuff. Whereas this is much more of a slog, although it's all enjoyable, you know, it's all fine, basically. But, you know, you want that buzz of getting a book out and finishing a project. On the other hand, you know, I wait and see what the reviewers say. The reviewers might say that this Nietzsche and the Burbs is a significant step on. And if it is, I'll try and rethink the way I work and try and work in this way from now on. Because maybe, you know, it's actually better than the other stuff I've done. On the other hand, maybe it'll be worse. It's like those bands that when they get really confident at playing their instruments, they lose what's good about their early work, you know.
That was Lars Eyre joining us down the line all the way from Tyneside. Not sure exactly where, somewhere in that region.
Yeah. Thank you for listening to Unsound Methods. You can find us online at unsoundmethods.co.uk. Find me and my writing at lachlanbloom.com or on Twitter at lachlanbloom.
I'm on jamiebatchin.com or at jamiebatchin on Twitter. Thank you for listening. Take care, and we'll talk to you again next month.
Ciao.